नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Canto 3, Chapter 14, Pregnancy of Diti in the Evening. And we're on text 1 and 2. 2 is on the board, so I'll just read number 1. Sri Shukru Vacha Nisamya Kosha Ravindo Parava Paravanitam Hare Katam Karnam Sukaratmanaha Una sapapracha tam uda ujatanjalir nachatit ripto viduro dhritabrataha. Translation. Shukadeva Goswami said, after hearing from the great sage Maitreya about the Lord's incarnation as Varaha, Vidura, who had taken a vow, begged him with folded hands to please narrate further transcendental activities of the Lord, since he, Vidura, did not yet feel satisfied. Text 2. Viduru vacha tenaiva tu muni shrestha harina yagna murtina adidaicho hiranyaksho Ata ityanu shushrama Viduru vacha. Sri Vidura said, Tena by him, Eva, certainly, to but Muni Shrestha, O chief amongst the sages, Arina, by the personality of Godhead, Yagna Murtina, the form of sacrifices, Adi, original, Daichaha, Dima, Hiranyakshaha, by the name Hiranyaksha, Ataha, slain, Iti, thus, Anushushruma, heard in succession. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Sri Vidura said, O chief amongst the great sages, I have heard by disciplic succession that Hiranyaksha, the original demon, was slain by the same form of sacrifices the personality of Godhead, Lord, bore. Please repeat. Sri Vidura said, O chief amongst the great sages, I have heard by disciplic succession that Hiranyaksha, the original demon, was slain by the same form of sacrifices the personality of Godhead, Lord bore. Report. As referred to previously, the Boar incarnation was manifested in two millenniums, namely Swayambhuva and Chakshusha. In both millenniums, there was a Boar incarnation of the Lord. But in the Swayambhuva millennium, he lifted the earth from within the water of the universe, whereas in the Chakshusha millennium, he killed the first demon, Hiranyaksha. In the Swayambhuva millennium, he assumed the color white, and in the Chakshusha millennium, he assumed the color red. Vidura had already heard about one of them, and he proposed to hear about the other. The two different four incarnations described are the one Supreme Personality of Godhead. So I'm going to read a couple of more verses, and then try to say something. So text 3. Tashya chodhavata shonim swadam stra graina lilaya daicharajasya chakraman What was the reason, O Brahmana, for the fight between the demon king and Lord Boar while the Lord was lifting the earth as his pastime? Text 4. Shraddhanaya bhaktaya bruhitaj janma vistaram rishena tripyati mana param kotu halam hime. My mind has become very inquisitive, and therefore I am not satisfied with hearing the narration of the Lord's appearance. Please, therefore, speak more and more to a devotee who is faithful. Purport. One who is actually faithful and inquisitive is qualified to hear the transcendental pastimes of the appearance and disappearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vidura was a suitable candidate to receive such transcendental messages. And text 5. Maitreya Vacha Saruvira Twaya Prishtam Avatara Katam Hare Yatvam Prichasi Marjanam Ritupasha Vishatanin. The great sage Maitreya said, "O warrior, the inquiry made by you is just befitting a devotee, because it concerns the incarnation of the Personality of Godhead. He is the source of liberation from the chain of birth and death for all those who are otherwise destined to die." Purport. The great sage Maitreya addressed Vidura as a warrior, not only because Vidura belonged to the Kuru family, but because he was anxious to hear about the chivalrous activities of the Lord in his incarnations of Varaha and Nrisimha. Because the inquiries concerned the Lord, they were perfectly befitting a devotee. A devotee has no taste for hearing anything mundane. There are many topics of mundane warfare, but a devotee is not inclined to hear them. The topics of the warfare in which the Lord engages do not concern the war of death, but the war against the chain of Maya, which obliges one to accept repeated birth and death. In other words, one who takes delight in hearing the war topics of the Lord is relieved from the chains of birth and death. Foolish people are suspicious of the Lord's taking part in the battle of Kurukshetra, not knowing that his taking part ensured the liberation for all those who were present on the battlefield. It is said by Bhishmadev that all who were present on the battlefield of Kurukshetra attained their original spiritual existences after death. Therefore, hearing the war topics of the Lord is as good as any other devotional service. Hare Krishna. Okay, so what are we talking about? That's the question. What are we talking about in our everyday lives? What is the topic of conversation? Where is our consciousness focused? And consequently, where will that lead us? This is the real topic of discussion. Let's talk about the topic. Then we'll talk about the topic, if you get to see what I mean. Yeah. So the topic here, of course, as Prabhupada said, is not the topics of death, which is the sum and total of all of the activities in the material world. Everything ends at a certain finite point, and that's the problem. Prabhupada once mentioned when we were here in Mayapur in 1976, he was giving his lecture on the topic of bhava, feeling. Bhava, of course, is the preliminary stage of love of Godhead, and love of Godhead is all about rasa. It's all about taste. I say that verse anyway, when I begin giving my Bhagavatam class, that the Sukadev Goswami, he says, "Know, O thoughtful man, bhavukaha," those people who are actually a little sober and thoughtful about what? About bhuvi, being on the earth. Bhuvi Bhavukaha. Means those who are on the earth, but they're a little sober. They're thoughtful, they think about what they're here for, they think about where they're going, and they talk. They begin talking about those topics which will help them in their journey, in their progress in this human form of life. So what is the topic? Sukhamukha, that which is coming from the mouth of Sukadev Goswami. Dravya, it's very relishable, it's very soft and juicy. Rasa, Rasika, it's all about the topics of relationships, but particularly about the relationships, alaya, which are eternal. Not just any ordinary relationships, which is the topics or subject matter of mundane men who are doomed to die in this material world. Rather, a thoughtful man wants to talk about that which invigorates his existence, which actually enlivens him in every respect, so that even the prospect of death becomes insignificant and not worthy of his attention. And this is the position of a devotee, a thoughtful man, Bhavukaha, that he is constantly absorbed in some topic which is actually useful. That's the whole point. Not talking about any old nonsense. There are so many books and magazines and TV shows and radio shows and endless. It's endless. Just talks about garbage. As Prabhupada says here, that a devotee has no taste for hearing anything mundane. There are many topics of mundane warfare. But a devotee is not inclined to hear them because they're all about death. That's all. So you talk about anything in the material world, and that's where it ends up. That point of infinity. Yeah, it's not eternal. It's not beneficial for the soul. Yeah, people like to talk about, especially people like to talk about war, and you see in the newspapers every day that there's so many wars that are going on all over the planet at any given time. This is what people's attention is actually fixed on. What does war mean? War means that they haven't got their relationship thing right. That's what it means. Yeah. You see in the bookstores there's lots of things about developing relationships. But what is war all about? It means that you've got it wrong. You haven't got the right rasa. Yeah? You don't understand what the real relationships are between living beings. Because you don't see what the ultimate relationship is. Because you don't see what the ultimate relationship is, then therefore any other relationship that you try to have will be mistaken. Yeah, we see that. That when people try to have relationships with each other, the basis of the relationship minus Krishna is competition, and that's what war is all about. Why are people fighting? It's not, well, because there are different kinds of wars that are going on. We don't necessarily mean the wars where, you know, we're firing atom bombs or cruise missiles, you know, or bullets. There's other kinds of warfare that's going on, even in ordinary everyday relationships. People are very quick, yeah, to attack each other. They're very quick to jump down each other's throats and try to somehow or another put the other person in an inferior position so that they can exert their supremacy. That's mundane relationships. And that's why you'll see that the history of the world is scattered with wars. Nothing but fighting going on all over the place. I was recently looking at the history of Britain, which is, it was a BBC series. And it was just a synopsis overview, century by century, of all the history of the British Isles, the glorious British Empire. Because it wasn't an empire when it first began, but it became one for a short period in time. But the basis for the whole presentation was, you know, in this century there was this war, and this war. And then in the next century, there was another war, and another war, and another war. And then in the next century, there was this king who fought with this guy, and then another king who fought with him and deposed him, and then when he became king, he was attacked by another group. Like this, century after century, every single century was just one war after the other. That's all there was. That was their history. And if you look at the history of any so-called civilization, it's a history of war. That's all, fighting. Because they haven't got the relationships down. They don't know what the real relationship is. And therefore, there's no juice, there's no rapsa. Well, not in the sense of, you know, the relishable juice that Sukadev Goswami is giving, which is soft and tender, yeah, and which pleases one in every respect. It's simply, you know, some bitter telling of one fight after another, one living being pitched against another, trying to dominate. That's all. So this is the material world. Everybody's trying to dominate over everybody else because everybody thinks that they are the enjoyer and they are the controller. And that's the sum and substance of material existence. Now, people like to read about these things when their minds are sunk into ignorance. Ignorance means there's a forgetfulness of real relationship, of real rasa. And in the mistaken consciousness, then one pursues, you know, another kind of happiness. But that's what everybody's doing, and that is the story of human life or any other life. Because Prabhupada says that rasas or sharing, if you like, an exchange of some kind of love, can only exist between beings in equal species. It doesn't cross species. Yeah, you can only have, a human being can only have his particular rasa with another human being. An animal, they have their rasas between each other, but you don't get any crossing of the rasas between the species. Because people are locked into a particular conception of themselves as the body and the mind. And they're trapped within that. And it limits their ability to have a relationship with another living being. As soon as we think that we are the body and that we are the mind, our primary purpose in life becomes how to give pleasure to it. That's all. How to please the senses, please the mind, please the intellect. At any cost. And what is the cost? The cost is the relationship that one has with other living beings. Therefore we see people in the human species, they think nothing of wiping out whole species. Yeah, different kinds of animals. They breed them, in fact, specifically for the purpose of killing them. It's inconceivable if you really think about it, but they actually breed other living beings specifically so that they, at some point they can slit their throats. Why? Because they want to enjoy the flesh, that's all. That's all. They just want to exploit them, they want to manipulate them, and they want to derive some kind of satisfaction from the destruction of that living being for the maintenance of their own bodies and their own senses. But this is not surprising then that nobody's happy. If we look at any relationship, this is really the basis, that it's one of exploitation. I want to be satisfied. I am this body, my senses demand, my mind demands, my intellect demands. And on the basis of that demand, I am driven to do all kinds of offensive activities against other living beings that I should be having a loving relationship with. Well, this is ignorance. So the Bhagavatam then, right from the very beginning, is meant to restore our true relationships. It's meant to bring our focus back to a relationship which is actually relishable, which actually gives pleasure not just to us, but to all living beings. So devotional service or spiritual life actually is cross-gender, cross-species, cross-everything. It transcends the limitations that are imposed on us by the identification that we have with the body. Then automatically, you can have then a relationship even with living beings and other species. A devotee has a loving relationship with a living being living beings in every species of life, because he sees that those living beings are living and not dead. He sees the body is dead, but the being within is alive, and that living being has a continuous eternal relationship with the supreme living being, the supreme personality of Godhead, who is the only one who is capable actually of having a relationship with every other living being, because all those living beings are parts of himself. So if one sees one's own relationship with the supreme personality of Godhead, then automatically there's an interest in relationships with all other living beings, because they're also parts and parcels of that same supreme whole. And therefore, one does not see oneself as being any different from any other living being. And then in that respect, then, there's no question of exploitation, there's no question of competition, there's no question of trying to dominate and fight with other living beings, you know, for one's own sense gratification. A devotee is empathetic with every other living being. He sees the happiness or distress of all other living beings as his own. Yeah, he has such a relationship with them. That's rasa. That's real rasa. That he feels for every other living being, and it's not artificial. He identifies. He has a oneness with every other living being because he understands that oneness that he has with Krishna and the oneness that they have with Krishna. So in that way then, as soon as the source, as soon as the original relationship is understood, all the other relationships become very pleasing. So the devotee then automatically, it's mentioned that he has all good qualities. Yeah? That means that he has perfect relationships with every other living being. What is a bad quality? A bad quality is something which it affects in an adverse way the progress of another living being that we're connected with. Or it may even affect our own progress as well. Atmahana, killer of the soul, a person who is actually envious of other living beings, or who has a relationship with other living beings which is aimed at destroying them, is actually only just destroying himself. Why? Because he's not getting his rasa. He's not getting any happiness in his own life, because his happiness depends on other living beings. Happiness is the relationship between oneself and other living beings, and centered on the supreme living being, Krishna. So if we don't have that, we're killing ourselves. That's atmahana. Of course, the soul can't be killed, but we die a death of relationship. That's all. Our relationships die. And if we have no relationships, we're as good as dead also. That's the point. Nobody can exist without relationship. Yeah. One has to have some kind of relationship with someone. Yeah. Not just not something, but someone. There's an interesting story, I think I've told this before, but it's nice, that there was one man, he was a priest, Christian priest, he was in some third world country, and there was some coup d'etat, yeah, some, you know, political change, and then everybody they didn't like, they captured and threw them into jails. So he was a missionary, so immediately he was captured, he was seen as an enemy of the state, they threw him in jail, and left him there for 8 years, alone, in solitary confinement. Yeah, for 8 years. He was put in a cell 8 feet by 6 feet. That was his whole existence for 8 years. Then, gradually there was a change in the politics, and then they decided to let this man out. So when he came out, he was perfectly normal. And the jailers were surprised. They said, how is it that you're completely normal? Everybody else that we've had put in this situation, solitary confinement, has gone crazy. After 1 or 2 years, they all gone mad. Well, how is it that you didn't go mad? So he said, because when I was put in, he said, I worship God I see God as my best friend. He says, so when anything happens to me, I always think that this is what God wants for me. This is the arrangement that He has made for me, and this is how, or this is the circumstances that He wants my friendship with Him to be developed. So when I was put in that cell, I immediately thought, this is the space that God has given me. Yeah? This is what He's provided for me. He's my friend. And so under this circumstance, I can continue to develop my friendship with God. And so he was not perturbed. Yeah, for 8 years, although he was seemingly alone, he wasn't alone at all. He had his relationship with God. And that fulfilled him to such a degree that he wasn't worried, you know, all right, temporarily there's some circumstance. That will change. He didn't panic. He didn't lose it. He didn't lose that which was the most valuable thing, which was with his relationship with God. So in the same way then, time, place, and circumstance has no bearing on the relationship that the soul has with God. The only thing that really has any bearing is his state of consciousness. Not the time, place, and circumstance. The state of consciousness. If he remembers God, any time, place, or circumstance doesn't matter to a devotee. He has that relationship, and he sees also his relationship with all other living beings. Even if another living being apparently is doing something against him, but a devotee doesn't think, this man is my enemy. He's limiting me. He's taking away my sense gratification. Yeah, he's attacking me in so many different ways. He doesn't see that. Therefore, Prahlad Maharaj, when he was being educated by his teachers, it wasn't having any effect on him. When his father, Hiranyakashipu, called him in and said, now what have you learned? Have you learned who is your friend and who is your enemy? Yeah, have you learned the politics and diplomacy that is required, you know, to be a king in this universe? No. I don't see anybody as my friend or my enemy. I see every living being as a part and parcel of Lord Vishnu. Why should I see them as my enemies? And then his father became very angry. And his father became an enemy. Of course, not for Prahlad. When his father became so inimical towards him and attacked him in so many ways, Prahlad did not have any feelings of enmity towards his father, Hiranyakashipu. What he was learning, or what he had already learned from the real teacher, Narada Muni, when he was in the womb of his mother, that sustained his relationships. So it's interesting actually, when he was talking about his father, initially he used to call him the best of the demons. He would never call him actually my father. After he was killed by Lord Vishringadev, then he said my father. It's an interesting point. But as long as Hiranyakashipu put himself in the position where he was feeling enmity towards Prahlad, it was difficult for Prahlad to realize the true rasa or taste of the relationship that he should have had with his own father. Therefore, he had to refer to him in the situation that Hiranyakashipu wanted to be in, which was as the best of the demons, inimical to so many other living beings. It didn't mean that Prahlad was inimical to him. It just meant that he couldn't have a proper relationship with him because his father wouldn't accept that relationship. Later on, when he was killed by Nrisimhadev, he was purified from his ignorance. He was restored back to his original position. Then Prahlad could say, yes, my father. Yeah. He could see him or deal with it in a favorable light again. Because now he was actually restored back to his relationship with Krishna, or with Lord Nrisimhadev, which was the relationship that Prahlad Maharaj was already in. So Prahlad's position didn't change, but it was the position of Hiranyakashipu that changed. And he had to deal with it accordingly. So in the same way, whatever time, place, and circumstance that we're in, If our consciousness is fixed on our relationship with Krishna, then nothing can disturb us. We remain as we are, fixed up, always relishing that supreme relationship, that exchange of love with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Other living beings that don't know about that relationship, their position apparently changes. They suffer so-called happiness and so-called distress. They move from one place to another, and they're always disturbed because they don't have that sense of relationship, true relationship. So when a devotee has to deal with a non-devotee, he does it on the basis of true relationship. It may not be appreciated by the person that he's dealing with. Hiranyakashipu certainly didn't like being told that you're also a part and parcel of Lord Vishnu, that the power that you have is just given to you. It's not naturally yours. Hiranyakashipu hated hearing that. He thought the power was his. He was the Lord of the universe. And Prahlad was saying, no, you're not the big guy. You know, you're not the Lord of everything that you survey. You're just a servant. That's all, the same as me. And Hiranyakashipu couldn't, you know, cope with hearing that. But Prahlad still gave it to him. He still informed him, even at risk. But he did it anyway, because he was content within himself. So the Prabhupada said, those who are preachers, sometimes they have to face so many difficulties. Yeah? Sometimes there are so many so-called enemies that try to attack them in different ways. But a devotee is a jatra-shatra. He's a person who has no enemies. It doesn't mean that somebody else is not feeling inimical to him, but it means that he's not feeling inimical to anybody else. So even when somebody attacks him, his position is secure. He has nothing to lose. Therefore, devotees will go out, risk their lives, yeah, for the purpose of introducing others to their eternal relationships with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they don't mind, actually, if sometimes some ignorant living being becomes agitated and disturbed. It's not the action of the devotee that's causing the agitation and the disturbance. It's the agitation and disturbance is already there within the consciousness of that living being, because he has no fixed point. He has no relationship. He's jumping from one place to another, from one body to another, from one species to another, continuously agitated. Yeah? With no sense of real relationship. Nothing to anchor himself. But a devotee, he has that sense. So when he's speaking to another person and trying to educate him for his own good, for his own benefit, that person, due to his own agitated sense of state of consciousness, he may become very angry. He may think about the devotee as being his enemy. But that's not reciprocated by the devotee. The devotee still tries to give that person that which is for his own benefit, for his own good. So nobody can be as big a benefactor for other living beings, not just human society, but any living being, than a devotee of the Lord. Because they're the ones that actually have that rasa. They know what rasa actually is. They know what true relationships are all about. And they can actually act for the real benefit of any other living being that they come in contact with, whether it's an ant, or a bird, or an animal, or a human being, or a demigod, it doesn't make any difference. So this is, therefore, Prabhupada says here that there are many topics, but any topic that which is in reference to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is supremely relishable, just like war. What we're about to hear is about a fight between the king of the demons, Hiranyaksha, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, why would that be relishable? You know, fighting, is that what relationships are all about? And in this instance, yes, it is. Why? because of the same point that he's making, Prabhupada's making here about the battle of Kurukshetra. Bhishmadev is, you know, making that point. That everybody that died, everybody that was killed on the battle of Kurukshetra went back to Godhead. Because Krishna was personally present. They had the chance to see Krishna every day, you know, driving the chariot of Arjuna. Seeing Krishna like that, one cannot fail to establish his relationship with him. He's so beautiful. He's so magnificent in every respect. All of his characteristics are so sublime. He's all attractive. That all attractive means that even in the middle of a battle, everybody has so many powerful, wonderful, loving feelings towards him. And therefore they can go back home, back to Godhead. When they die, they think there is Krishna. And they're accepted by Krishna into his eternal entourage. So, even the Lord fighting on the battle of Kurukshetra then is a relishable topic for the devotees. Prabhupada also makes the point that pseudo-devotees, those who don't really understand the position of the Lord and the relationship that he has, they don't like to hear about the battle of Kurukshetra. They say the Bhagavad Gita, oh, that is external. We have no business with that. The only business that we want to hear about is Krishna, you know, in the forests of Vrindavan dancing with the gopis. That's the real rasa. But that's not a fact according to the Bhagavatam. Not at least according to Maitreya and Vidura. Vidura is very enlivened to hear about the form of the Lord in a hog, as a hog, fighting with a demon. He's so enlivened by it, he's demanding, please give me more and more, speak to me. Yeah? This is the topic, this is what we want to talk about. What you're saying to me is wonderful. I want to hear more and more. Give me more and more details. So he's already heard about the Lord lifting up the earth. Now he wants to hear about the Lord in the same form, doing another pastime, fighting with this big demon. And it's very, very enlightening to him. So this is the nature then of the Bhagavatam. That it's meant for those who have the highest taste. People who have no taste, they won't appreciate the Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, and other Vedic literatures. They have a taste for something else, something dead. But a devotee, he has a taste for life. And that's really the difference. Okay, so we'll finish there. Does anybody have any comments or questions? Shastra Kripkabu. Shastra Kripkabu is from Los Angeles. He says there that I told a story once about, I was told this by Upendra Prabhu when I first joined the movement in Sydney in 72. Upendra was there. He had been Prabhupada's servant. So he used to tell us different stories about Srila Prabhupada. So one time he told us that somebody had asked Srila Prabhupada, how long did it take you to perfect your chanting? And Prabhupada replied, 30 years. So, I always used to wonder about, well, what does that mean? You know, what stage is your chanting considered to be perfect? I mean, there are so many stages of devotional service, there's so many, you know, depths that you can go into. Like an ocean. So at what stage do you consider that you've penetrated the ocean? You can just keep on going down and down and down. So what is perfection of chanting? But one thing that I gauged that by, that I understood it by, was much later on I heard this story about Srila Prabhupada when he was living in the Radha Damodar Mandir in the early 60s, and this was just right at the very beginning when he started work on the Bhagavatam and writing these transcendental purports, that he had some exchange, personal exchange with Rupa, Sanatan and Jiva Goswamis. They actually appeared before him and gave him some direct instructions about how to write the Bhagavatam and how to preach Krishna consciousness in preparation for his going around the world. So that occurred probably in 60, 61, around that time, because that was when Prabhupada was, you know, first seriously dedicating all of his time to his writing of the Bhagavatam. So if you look back and you see when Prabhupada took initiation, that was right at the end of 32 or just at the beginning of 33. So 30 years means 62-63. It's just right that period when he was writing the Bhagavatam, when he was having visitations from his Guru Maharaj, several times that happened, when he was getting personal instruction from the six Goswamis about his writing. That was the point at which Prabhupada said his chanting was perfect. So now, you're asking at what point will our chanting become perfect? So who can say? It will become perfect when we give up the taste for material life, when we give up the taste for trying to enjoy these bodies and minds, and when we develop our taste for glorifying Krishna. That's what Prabhupada was doing. All of his rasa, all of his taste was pouring out through the words that he was writing in his commentaries on the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada said, these purports are my devotional ecstasies. The rasa is there in these purports, and all you've got to do is read them. You've just got to develop a taste for reading these purports, and we'll experience the same taste that Prabhupada was experiencing. And he was experiencing the same taste, Sukha Mukha Dravya, the same taste that Sukadeva Goswami was experiencing. In that purport, actually, Prabhupada mentions that Sukadeva Goswami was not noted for the fact that he could repeat everything that his father, Vyasadeva, told him. That's not what he was noted for. What he was noted for was that he was able to repeat that, but with this rasa, this taste, this juice that was added to it. It wasn't just mere repetition, but he was relishing the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in the same way, Srila Prabhupada was relishing the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that he received in this cyclic succession from Sukadeva, Vyasadeva and others. And therefore, when we read Prabhupada's purports, we get the same taste. And that's why it had effect. That's not just some dry, you know, grammatical translation work of some Sanskrit, you know, verses. No, Prabhupada was actually relishing at every moment the taste of his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And therefore it comes out on every page of the Bhagavatam. And anybody who's a little bit thoughtful, Bhavukaha, they'll relish the same taste. They'll read this and then they'll immediately become enlivened. And the more enlivened we become, the more we enter into these transcendental topics. Until we're lost in them. Until we forget our material identity. We forget we're in the material world. And we're only aware of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and its pastimes and his existence. At that point, maybe then we'll have perfected our chanting. Because to be able to chant, you have to hear. That's the two go together, hearing and chanting. So if we want to chant nicely, we have to hear nicely. If we're not chanting nicely, it's because we're not hearing nicely, and therefore we should spend more time. as much time as is necessary to chant and to hear about the pastimes of the Supreme Lord. And then all the imperfections will go away. In one sense, we're already perfect because we're spirit souls. Our existence is inviolable. Yeah? It's infallible. The problem is the state of our consciousness, which is what I was saying at the beginning. It's not really the time, place, and circumstances. It's just the state of our consciousness. It's what we decide to do at any one moment. It's where we decide to direct our consciousness. Then we'll get a result. So if we want perfection in life, which means we want to become perfectly happy, we want to relish these relationships to the highest degree, that's our choice. So our perfection comes when we only choose Krishna and we don't choose anything else. Our problems come when we start choosing other things other than Krishna. And then we suffer. We suffer a loss in relationship, a kind of a covering, a diminishment of our sense of our relationship with Krishna. That's what we suffer. And all these people that are suffering, that are in anxiety, that are crying in so many different ways, that are taking out their frustration and their envy on other living beings, what are they doing? They're just crying out for a relationship with Krishna. That's all. If they get that relationship, they'll feel perfectly pacified. Not just pacified, but enlivened. And then their whole relationship with everybody else will change into something very positive and wonderful. That's perfection. Any other questions? We've got Chaitanya Prabhu. Yes, Sridhar Chaitanya Prabhu's asking about this meeting, visitation, if you like, that Prabhupada had with Rupa and Sanat and Jiva Goswami. I had heard about that when I first joined Prabhupada's party in 75. I was told by Hari Kesh, who was Prabhupada's cook at that time, that Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami had personally instructed Prabhupada about his preaching and his going to the West. But he didn't know any of the details of it. And I couldn't find anybody else that knew about it. And I didn't, you know, it's not something you can just walk into Prabhupada's room and say, can you please tell me about the time Rupa Goswami, you know, appeared before you? You have to wait, and when the opportune moment comes, then you, if you get the chance, you can ask. So I waited, and about 7 months later, 8 months later, we were in England, and Prabhupada had been talking with some of the devotees about the new French Bhagavatam, and it had just been published, Bhagavan Prabhu and Pritapudra Swami. They flew from France. They gave the first copies to Srila Prabhupada. So we were looking through that Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada was talking, and then at some point the others went out of the room. So I was left alone with Srila Prabhupada. And I've been looking through the pages of the French Bhagavatam, and I saw there was a picture of Prabhupada's kitchen at the Radha Damodar Mandir. And, you know, the seats there, there's that little jolly grill window. And he could sit there and look out and he could see Rupa Goswami's, you know, samadhi. So I was looking at that, I told Srila Prabhupada, oh, they put a picture of your rooms in the Radha Damodar here. So Prabhupada was immediately interested. He said, oh, let me see, like that. So then he started talking about the rooms. And, you know, he mentioned how he'd been given these rooms and he fixed one up and how he was paying 5 rupees a month for the 2 rooms. And he said, now I'm paying 10 rupees. And so he was, you know, just very open, and it was very congenial. So I have this in my mind about, somehow or another it came to me about this story about Rupa Goswami. And then Prabhupada said everything was going on by superior arrangement. So as soon as he said that, I knew this is it, this is the chance. So I said, well, I was told that Rupa Goswami appeared before you and gave you some instructions about your preaching in the West. And then Prabhupada's mood immediately changed. And he said, oh, everybody knows that. Yeah, he said, it's well known. He said, everybody knows that. And then he changed the topic. So he didn't want to talk about it, but he did confirm that it happened. So then after that, that was 76, and I never heard anything again about it at all in nearly 30 years. And then in 2004, Mula Prakriti, our god sister, just before she left her body, she put this book out called Srila Prabhupada, Friend to All. Our Srila Prabhupada, Friend to All. And she had interviewed people that knew Prabhupada before he came to the West. So one of those men was this Gopal Chandra Ghosh, who is one of the main people in the Vrindavan Research Institute, which is 2 blocks away from our Krishna Balaram Mandir. And, you know, it's interesting. They have original works of Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami. They actually have some of the original palm leaf writings and things in that research institute. So this man, in the early 60s, was a student. He was 20 years old. And he used to go to the Radha-Damodar Mandir. He saw Srila Prabhupada had moved into the rooms there. He knew that he was writing. And he used to come there and he would offer his obeisances to Srila Prabhupada. He was a, you know, he was a resident sannyasi. And that, so, and not only that, he used to talk with him sometimes. So one time he went there and he said Prabhupada was suffering from a heavy cold. He had blankets on and he was, you know, really not well. And then the next day he came and he was perfectly all right. And he was so surprised by it that he asked him what happened. And then Prabhupada told him, he said he was very jubilant, and he told him that last night in my dreams, my Guru Maharaj appeared to me, and he gave me instructions how to write this Bhagavatam. He said I was in too much anxiety about how to write it, what to say, so my Guru Maharaj has given me instructions how to do this, and he told me that you just follow the acharyas, you follow the 6 Goswamis, they'll give you all understanding how to present this Bhagavatam nicely. So he said that he was very happy. He said, I got the blessings of my Gurudev. So then he said, then later on, sometime maybe in the winter, he doesn't give the year, but I can understand it was 61, 62 around that time, because it was at the beginning of when Prabhupada was writing. So then he came again, and he said Prabhupada was sitting and he was chanting, and tears were just pouring from his eyes as he was chanting. So he could understand from Prabhupada's demeanor that something had happened. So he asked him, you know, is there something that you want to talk about? You know, did something happen? So initially Prabhupada wouldn't say anything, but then he pressed him a little bit more, you know, did something happen? So then Prabhupada told him that in the night time he had been chanting next to Rupa Goswami's Bhajan Kuti and his Samadhi. They're both there. And then he said 3 very effulgent personalities appeared before him. He said one was older and taller. He said that 2 in the front, they were older and they were just wearing kopins and they had japamala hanging around their necks. And they were very effulgent and beautiful. He said that was Rupa and Sanatana Goswamis. And then behind them was a much younger sadhu, dressed similarly to them, but very beautiful face, lotus-like eyes. And that was Jiva Goswami, their nephew. So he said they've given me instructions how to write this Bhagavatam and for my preaching work. But then he said, then Gopal Chandra Goshi said, that's all he would tell me. he wouldn't say anything more. So I'm always a bit wary about things that people remember and, you know, relationships that they claim to have had with Srila Prabhupada before he came to the West. Mainly because, you know, first thing is memory is very faulty. And the second thing is that when nobody knows you, nobody knows you. And when everybody knows you, I know you. In other words, when somebody's a nobody, you know, nobody will claim a relationship. But when somebody becomes famous, oh, I knew it. He was my best friend. I used to go around there all the time. Yeah. So you have to be very careful about what people claim, you know, about their relationships with Prabhupada and stories from the past. But this particular story is a fact, because Prabhupada, at least I know it's a fact, because Prabhupada confirmed it to me in 1976. Oh, everybody knows that. So there must have been other people that knew it too, but at least he confirmed the fact that Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Jiva Goswami did appear before him. So that, you know, that's Prabhupada's relationship. So at least we can trust that story. It's a fact. Well, we can say it would be logical, but not necessarily. I'm sure there are many other great devotees, or there were many other great devotees in the Gaudiya Math and other places, but they may not have had the same experience. With Srila Prabhupada, he was specifically empowered to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. That required, you know, a specific kind of spiritual energy, which he got from the six Goswamis. He was empowered by Lord Chaitanya through the disciplic succession to do what he did. Not everybody did that, even those who were pure devotees. So everybody, of course, ultimately they do have their relationships, and I'm not saying that nobody else had an experience, you know, with the previous acharyas or, you know, Krishna or whatever, or the deities, or, I mean, many, many devotees, you know, who we would regard as being very simple, humble, nondescript personalities, they have sometimes, you know, dreams of Krishna, and they get instructions and like that. So for a devotee, it's really not that unusual in that sense. But what's significant for us is that Srila Prabhupada, having gotten that association and instruction, actually used it. He wrote the Bhagavatam. He wrote the purports to the Bhagavatam. He wrote his purports to the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Yeah, he went out from Vrindavan. He didn't stay there, you know, at Rupa Goswami's samadhi, relishing his relationship. He went out and he spread it all over the world. That's what's significant. Yeah, otherwise, yeah, it's very nice, you know, to have a dream of the deities, or, you know, to have a little exchange. I mean, we, here in Mayapur, we see frequently, you know, Lord Jagannath, he's having pastimes even with the Muslims. Yeah? They're not people that are naturally inclined to worship deities. In fact, they think that, you know, the deity form of the Lord is the biggest offense that you can ever make against God. It's to put the Lord into a form, a tangible form. But in Rajpur there, we even have Muslims coming and, you know, offering their obeisances to Lord Jagannath because they've had these exchanges with them. So that's not unusual. Krishna can appear before anybody. But it's how you receive it also. It's what you do with it. Yeah? You can be given all good fortune, but if you don't do anything with it, but that's why Prabhupada is so singular. Yeah, why Srila Prabhupada is so special amongst all the disciples of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And in fact, it was predicted by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati when they were in Radhakund in 1935, and some of the Gaudiya members were trying to persuade Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati that Abhay Babu, or Abhay Charanaravinda as he was at that time, he was initiated, should be made the new temple president of the new Bombay Gaudiya Mat, because he had induced some wealthy people to give them money, and he had helped to organize it. So they said, well, why not let Abhay, let him become the temple president there? And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said, no. He said, he is better off outside of your company. That was his words. He said, he's better off outside of your company. In the future, he will do everything himself. And Prabhupada told me, he said that when Guru Maharaj said that, he said, I was thinking, in the future, I will do everything? What does that mean? He had no conception himself at that point, but Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said that. And in 1977, we were in Calcutta, and Abhiram was the temple president there at that time. He and I were in Prabhupada's room with him, and Prabhupada was recalling something about his relationship with this Guru Maharaj, how he had a very friendly relationship in some respects. He said many of the other disciples, they were afraid, actually, they were just afraid to even come into the presence of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta because he was so stern sometimes, and he was so heavy in his preaching, cutting like that. But Prabhupada said, I always felt very, like a very natural relationship with him. And in fact, their exchanges were so sweet that one of the other God brothers actually warned Srila Prabhupada. He said, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. He was trying to warn him, you're getting too close to Guru Maharaj. And Prabhupada said, when he told me that, I just thought, well, I may be a fool, but that's my relationship. So, at that point, I asked Prabhupada, or Abhiram asked Prabhupada, did your Guru Maharaj know that you would go on to do what you have now done? And Prabhupada said yes. So even at that time, Prabhupada himself didn't know what he was going to be doing in the future. But he was a surrendered soul. And when he was given something, he actually used it. That's the whole, that's the real point. And that's why Prabhupada is, amongst all of his peers, a singular personality. Why he is special, because he's the one who actually went out and did it. Everybody else talked about it, but Prabhupada is the one who actually went and did it. Alright? Okay, we better finish though, it's getting very late. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.